I had kun ikke den ting en season.
Oh, cedar's good, because you people, lots of people I met, not you, not all of you, before I get to that poem again, it's called Seed Journey, eating organic food and all that. This is your horror.
He had can only dig ginseng and seasons.
All right. There, it's called Seed Journey. There they go, and where they stop, trees will grow. The nuts of amnesic squirrels, more nuts will be. Burr takes spray on animal fur and pollen the wind does carry. But for some seeds, meal is the end of the journey. All right, I know what I'm going to do, and then I'm going to blow on this one. Here we go.
Two lost ginseng hunters in Estill County today.
Search crews found the pair deep inside of the woods that way. They say luckily they are safe that way. They just had some car trouble.
Crews say the two were reported missing more than a day ago. Today, state troopers and Fish and Wildlife crews went into the woods searching for them, and luckily they were found shortly before noon. Crews say the two were near their car, which had gotten stuck in a creek, and that's why they never returned the day they were supposed to.
We just had some car trouble.
Rescuers reportedly say the ginseng hunters told them their dog actually caused the situation by accidentally knocking the car out of gear, which caused it to roll into the creek.
We just had some car trouble.
And ginseng harvesting season just began at the start of this month, so crews say, you are going to be out here looking for it.
The heck can only dig ginseng in seasons.
Please be careful. Covering the news in Estill County from the LEXT Mobile Newsroom.
Deep.
Please be careful.
I have had some taken from me before. Yeah, I don't know if these guys did it, but somebody
has.
Please be careful.
Yeah, we own the property on this side of the road also, and I have some in the pine tree. We've been watching it, and just boom, one day it's gone. I haven't been over there to see what they've got this time, but I'm assuming they probably got it from them out.
County Sheriff's Department and the Ohio Department of Natural Resources were on the scene.
Because basically what's happened is the two suspects that we have run off into the woods and are hiding somewhere. A canine unit from Danville has come out to assist us to look for them. And they're down in the woods now to look to see if they can find a scent trail.
Please be careful.
Of people that were down there digging ginseng illegally. The heck can only dig ginseng in season starts September 1st. It has to be a three-pronged plant or better to ripen berries. You have to have written permission from the landowner, and you also have to keep daily accurate records of your ginseng digging. And those are what you would have to do if you were digging ginseng. And in this case, that has not happened. The heck can only dig ginseng in season starts September 1st.
My name's Tanner Filia. I'm the plant propagation manager at United Plant Savers, and located here in Meigs County, Ohio, down in the southeastern portion of the state, kind of in the Appalachian foothills here. So we're kind of right into the edge of the Appalachian region here, and we primarily focus on the conservation of at-risk medicinal plants found throughout North America. But we do a lot of work with the species that are endemic here to Appalachia, a lot of the, you know, big name medicinal herbs that tend to get wild harvested and sold into the botanical trade and have a long history of harvest and use, so, and thus have a lot of sustainability concerns as well.
Is there a big underground market for that? Is that?
I mean, there is illegal trade in some plant material, but primarily ginseng. You know, most of the plants that are harvested, say golden seal, black cohosh, bloodroot, Solomon seal, a lot of the big name, you know, woodland medicinals don't have any, you know, state or federal regulations, you know, guiding their harvest and sale. You know, ginseng is the exception. You know, it is federally regulated, you know, because it's listed on the CITES Treaty, which is the Convention on the International Trade of Endangered Species, as a species of concern. So the trade is heavily regulated at the, you know, federal level down to the state level. You know, so you do have a legal sale of ginseng, you know, because the sale is regulated. You have to be, you know, a licensed buyer to, you know, to buy it and sell it. So it's basically people going outside of the licensing requirements for the sale of ginseng. And then also the illegal harvest, you know, mainly comes in the form of harvesting on private property without permission, you know. So a lot of people refer to that as poaching. You know, when that happens to somebody who grows ginseng intentionally, you know, in their forest, that is no longer poaching, but theft. You know, it's the same act of, you know, taking that ginseng from private land without permission from the landowner. And then also harvesting on, you know, federal land, national parks. That gets a lot of attention, you know, down in the Great Smoky Mountains, you know, the Blue Ridge Parkway, you know, through that area, where they've done a lot of work with trying to curtail illegal ginseng harvesting. So that's where a lot of the black market is, per se. But most of the plants don't really have any regulations, so technically not a lot of illegality in that sense, you know, aside from illegal, you know, harvesting on private land. You know, poaching and theft from growers is, you know, still a problem. But, you know.
So the ginseng, I guess I know ginseng is used medicinally in, you know, in other countries, and so that's where the big sale price comes from, right? What is yep. black cohosh and bloodroot used for?
Well, you know, there's not really a whole lot of bloodroot used on the market. As far, you know, and I'm not an herbalist, and I don't have exactly, you know, these yeah. things are largely informal, you know, so the trade volume that we do know of basically comes from companies that are, you know, buying, making products. But, you know, black cohosh is used quite widely for different traditionally, it's been used for, you know, hormone kind of replacement therapy for, you know, menopause. It's also a muscle relaxer. You know, it has a ton of cultural uses that date back, you know, long time that I am not really up on. You know, I'm not an herbalist per se. I'm more of a conservationist and ecologist and focus more on how these plants, you know, function in their native habitats and how we can sustainably produce them in an ecologically sound way.
So these, like ginseng and black cohosh, are those, and I guess the other one would be golden seal, are those pretty common in Ohio?
Well, yeah, throughout the Appalachian region, yes. Black cohosh, I would say, is probably the most common. It's, you know, it can occupy a wider variety of habitats. So you can get into places into, you know, West Virginia, Southwest Virginia, North Carolina, where black cohosh can become, you know, pretty abundant in the forest understory. There's quite a bit here in Ohio where we have larger tracts of forest. You know, these are all forest plants. So, you know, the more forest you have and the older that forest is, the more likely you are to have more robust population. So as you move into central and southern Appalachia, where the forest cover increases, you tend to have larger populations. You know, Ohio, we're down here in the southeast portion of the state, and we are the most heavily forested portion of Ohio. You know, so we do have larger populations in this area, but as you go into the other portions of Ohio out of the foothills, you really don't see it much. So you can pretty much kind of just envision a band from, you know, western North Carolina kind of all the way on up to, you know, Maine through the kind of that Appalachian mountain range there. And these plants can be found all throughout. We don't have a great sense of, you know, these plants aren't studied in great, like their populations aren't being studied in great numbers. So we don't have a great sense of what the total populations are out there, but black cohosh is certainly more common than most people would think. And, you know, ginseng has obviously been harvested. There's a lot of harvest pressure in that, you know, high value for ginseng. And golden seal now, too, is in very high demand. And so as that demand goes up, you know, harvest pressure increases and the populations decrease. So, you know, golden seal in our area and throughout much of central Appalachia into West Virginia and Southwest Virginia and Pennsylvania is being heavily harvested right now. And the price is increasing pretty significantly. So the price for wild golden seal has probably tripled or quadrupled almost. Probably not quadrupled, but tripled, you know, in the last, you know, probably seven, eight years. So, and it's becoming harder and harder to find as planting stock, you know, for people who want to grow it, you know, in their forest. It's becoming, you know, increasingly difficult to get planting stock as well, because all the roots kind of just getting sucked up into the, there's so much demand.
And so there's nobody really keeping, in Ohio, do you guys have a natural heritage program or?
There is a natural kind of natural areas and preserves is what we kind of have through the ODNR. There are arts and cultural heritage programs in Ohio that have, you know, they do more of like documenting, and United Plant Savers certainly does this as well, you know, participates in trying to document, you know, stories, you know, people's connection to these plants. You know, there is a very strong cultural connection, you know, on many, many levels from many different cultures, you know, with these plants in this region. So that is an area that is still pretty wide open, or really, I mean, I think there's a lot of work that could be done on kind of that more folk life side of, you know, of things, and capturing some of those stories, you know, that are out there and whatnot.
It's always funny, like this, like ginseng in my neck of the woods in New England, you know, ginseng is a pretty uncommon plant. Black cohosh is a pretty uncommon plant. I don't think I've ever seen black cohosh in the woods up here.
Interesting.
And I'm out in the woods a lot. Bloodroot is very common. I see bloodroot all over the place.
Yep.
The hydrastis, the golden seal, never seen it in the woods.
Mm-hmm.
All the, like, mandrakes, polyphyllum, those are, you know, when we do find them in the woods, we think they're planted.
Okay. Like,
so when I go down south or, you know, just, you know, into New York, even just a little west of here.
Yep.
The plants and the diversity of these particular plants that we're sort of talking about is much higher than what I'm used to seeing or ever see.
Yeah, I don't get. I've never really been all the way up to the north northeast. I've been to certain areas, and certain areas I've been to, the diversity is definitely lower. You know, the plants that are common here are not common there. Or, you know, things that are not common here are more common there. So basically, I mean, if you think of Charleston, West Virginia, you know, they kind of say if you do about a 300-mile radius around Charleston, West Virginia, is kind of the heart of the range of, say, golden seal. You know, 'cause that's right kind of in the center of, you know, the center of it all, you know, the whole, like, Appalachian region. So you get into, you know, Eastern Kentucky and, you know, kind of get into that, some of those areas there. But yeah, so more in central Appalachia is kind of the richest kind of concentration, central and southern, I would say. Still a lot of diversity out there, you know, and like I said, it's very much linked to forest and like what the history of your forest use is in your area. I mean, this area was completely deforested in 1900. There were you know, there's less than 5%, you know, maybe even less than 2% forest left in this region. It was all cut for timber and used for coal mining and for smelting iron ore and, you know, And so if you have a heavy history of repeated timber harvest and, you know, your populations are going to tend to be lower, you know, if you have a lot of agricultural, past agricultural land use where those forests are, you know, reverting, you know, successionally from open pasture land back to hardwood forest, you know, that takes a long time for the species to reaccumulate. You know, could take hundreds of years before we start seeing those, you know, more climax species come back in.
Do you have any idea, like, what percentage of Ohio's forested now?
It's about 35%, I think. 35, 37, somewhere right in that ballpark. And it's mostly what we call an Appalachian, we're in the Appalachian counties of Ohio, so the foothills kind of makes a band down here through the eastern and southeastern and southern part of the state.
Cool.
So we get a little bit of elevation here, you know, and the flora is definitely more southern. It's, you know, you get all the species that you get down in, you know, West Virginia, mountains, kind of in the more older forests.
Is spring starting at all there?
Just starting a little bit. We had a couple warm days this week. You know, it's going to dip back down. Generally, you know, we can still be fairly cool into mid-April. But definitely, you know, ramps are starting. You know, ramps are a big one that we work with around here. You know, obviously ramps have a high harvest pressure, big demand. It's another one where you get a lot of illegal harvesting. But ramps are starting to push up. They're our first, you know, thing to really come up in the spring. So ramp season is just a couple weeks off. And, you know, then we'll start getting into morels in the middle of April. And that, you know, can go either way, a good season or bad season. You never know, really, how the weather's going to cooperate for you. But,
yeah.
So, yeah, it's starting, but it's still... still leafless, and you know, nothing's popped yet. No, the red maples are our first trees generally to open up, and they're swelling, but you know, it's still kind of still probably get one more sap run off the maple trees for like maple syrup producers before that's over.
Is that a big I guess that's a Maybe we should introduce the topic here.
Yeah, I guess.
and just give it a little definition.
Yeah, you know, non-timber forest products are, you know, basically any product that comes from the forest that's not, you know, a saw log or timber or something like that. I mean, so generally there's three different categories, you know, bins that we tend to lump these products into. So we have you know, decorative and craft products. So, you know, you get a lot of this out in the Pacific Northwest, or maybe even up in the Northeast there, you get stuff like, you know, pine boughs, grapevine, you know, wild grapevines for making like wreaths, you know, pine cones, you know, floral greens, galax, you know, stuff like that down from the Southern Appalachians that go into the, you know, cut flower trade, fern fronds, all that kind of stuff. So those are your decorative and your floral products. And then you have your edibles. So wild mushrooms are a big one, wild and cultivated, you know, forest grown, intentionally produced mushrooms. You know, maple syrup, ramps, fiddlehead ferns, you know, all that kind of stuff. Anything you eat, berries, you know, those all classify as non-timber forest products. And then the medicinals, which is kind of what we've been focusing on in our conversation so far, you know, your medicinal roots, leaves, barks, you know, there's a lot of all those types of botanicals, you know, fall kind of into the medicinal non-timber forest products bin. So the non-timber forest products industry goes a couple different ways. You have your wild harvesters, and then you have kind of your forest farmers, you know, people who are producing it, intentionally in their forest land, you know, using those kind of forest farming production systems like wild simulated production or woods cultivated production, you know, which we can talk a little bit about.
Is one better than the other, wild harvesters versus forest farmers?
Well, it very much depends on, you know, what the product is, you know. So say for wild mushrooms, you know, there's a huge industry of wild mushroom pickers and buyers in the Pacific Northwest. You know, there's a whole circuit where they, you know, cycle through, you know, California up through Oregon and Washington and then all the way up into, you know, British Columbia and Alaska. And they follow, you know, the spring and the spring flushes. And there's been a lot of work done on this, you know. You know, the U.S. Forest Service actually has had some folks, you know, who specialize in non-timber forest products. Because a lot of these things, like wild mushrooms, you know, those things are legally forageable out on, you know, federal land, you know, in some cases state land. You know, there's obviously illegal mushroom picking. There's been a lot of books and stuff documenting that whole industry. But, you know, those are wild mushrooms. And now here in the East, not every state allows the sale of wild mushrooms. So Ohio, it's basically illegal. You know, there's no formal, you know, it does happen, but there's no formal market, you know, for wild mushrooms. You might find a restaurant or something that's going to buy it and, you know, slip it on the menu and, you know, nobody's going to come knocking, but, you know, it's not good. But here in one state away in Michigan, you know, they can harvest like all types of, you know, they can harvest porcini and trumpet mushrooms and chanterelles and all these types of wild mushrooms, and they can, you know, market them and sell them. And, you know, there's a whole verification process for collectors. You know, they basically get certified and trained. They know what they're identifying. And like the buyers, you know how to identify the mushrooms and all that. So there's certification programs, you know, for that type of industry, you know, because it's become, you know, more formalized, even though it's fairly still informal. But we don't really have that per se for herbs. Anyhow, so, you know, that's kind of a way where it's like, you know, in some cases you can wild harvest, but in some cases, you know, it might be make more sense to cultivate. So the people that I tend to work with, you know, through United Plant Savers and my previous work and private consultations are forest landowners. So you can utilize basically, you know, cull wood, you know, through sustainable, low-impact forest management, either trees that are, you know, naturally overtopped or blow down or get damaged in a storm. You can use those to cultivate a wide variety of gourmet mushrooms, you know, like shiitake, oyster, lion's mane, and medicinal mushrooms as well. Most of those are medicinal, and you can, you know, grow reishi, you know. So there's, you know, different strokes for different folks, you know. So some mushrooms you just can't cultivate, you know. Morels are just really not cultivatable. You know, they're a mycorrhizal species. They grow in the wild, you know, so you go out and you have to forage them. You know, same thing with chanterelles. Anything that's mycorrhizal and is depending on that symbiotic relationship with tree roots, you know, it's in living trees, it's really not easy to cultivate. But anything that's a decay fungi that, you know, wants to basically colonize a freshly died or freshly killed piece of wood and decompose it, you know, you can grow all those pretty easily. So just depends on what you have access to, you know.
A couple of years ago, a guy gave me, like, it was during morel season, and morels around here, you know, I am slightly jealous of, again, the people in the a little further south and west of me, but the morel flushes around here aren't very big. You might, mm-hmm. I've had a couple years where I've gotten maybe like 20,
mm-hmm.
And that's from a lot of different sites. You know, they're usually small patches.
Yeah.
And this guy gave me morel slurry, he called it. And it was like he took some of it, some of the morels, and ground them up and then mixed them with some other things. And he wouldn't tell me what was in it, but it was like a gallon jug of concentrate. And he told me to cut it with, you know, water and then put it out. But I never saw anything come up.
It's hit or miss. I mean, you can do that. That's, I mean, that's really the only way. I mean, so basically what he's doing is he's, you know, blending up the mushrooms, getting the spores in the slurry. He probably put some kind of, like, you know, other thing in there to maybe for the mushrooms to, like, maybe feed on or something.
Oats or something, I think, yeah. Or maybe wood chips. He put something in there that was really...
Yeah, I mean, so morels are interesting because they can be decomposers, like, for part of their life cycle, so saprophytes, and then, you know, they become mycorrhizal on a tree host. So, you know, basically, yeah, you're taking that out there, you're dumping it around the root system of a host tree. So, of course, you know, there's certain trees that work better, so you want a good, the right species, and dumping it out there and hoping that, you know, something takes hold and colonizes the root system of that tree and then might produce morels in the future. I have heard of it working, and I've personally have thrown out, you know, a lot of scraps in a certain area and, you know, did find morels there in a small quantity years later. But, you know, who knows?
Yeah, no, I usually think of them being associated with, like, white ash trees up here and elms. And apple trees.
Yeah.
And so in Ohio, what are they?
So in Ohio, you have American elm, generally the ones that are in decline or freshly dying. There was a strong association with white ash, which we lost all the white ash to the emerald ash borer over the last 5 years. So that's not a viable host tree anymore. Tulip poplar is a decent host. Sycamore tends to host a lot of good flushes. You know, that's where I tend to find the biggest ones because they're usually down in bottomland, you know, wetter sites. But yeah, I mean, actually, there's a guy here. He teaches at the local community college, and he's got a PhD in forest ecology, and he did a study somewhere up in the Northeast when he was doing his PhD work. I remember he was telling me that they were basically sampling sugar maple tree roots to basically see if morel, you know, hyphae were living on the root system, or if there was, I can't remember if they were looking for morel specifically or just what mushroom species were living on the roots symbiotically. And he said almost every single tree, sugar maple, that they tested had the Morchella living on it, but they almost never flush mushrooms. So that's a complex thing about some, I think, part of the life cycle of the mycorrhizal mushrooms. You know, I feel like they flush the hardest when the tree is stressed or dying. You know, obviously they're losing their host and they want to reproduce. So I think that's possibly why you find a lot of good flushes around the dying elms. But we had good flushes around the dying ash too. But yeah.
But there's a time limit on that. So after they're after those hosts are dead for enough years, the morels go away.
Yeah, and then like you might find like a couple, and that's what I was talking about. The life cycle of the morel can be like saprophytic as well as mycorrhizal. So sometimes, you know, it's been referred to me, like this is how it was described to me, is, you know, basically after the host dies, you might find like one mushroom, you know, or two or something, but they're basically, they're not living on the tree. They're either probably living on some decaying piece of the root as a saprophyte, or like, you know, they're basically just trying to jump, you know, to like try and find a new host, you know, so they might be just persisting as a saprophyte, you know, on some decomposing piece of wood, just as an opportunity to maybe produce some more spores and try and, you know, move, I guess, you know, is how it was described to me, or how I understand it, you know.
Can you tell me a little bit about like how United Plant Savers sort of, you know, I took a class that you guys offered a couple of years ago for stimulated ginseng, so I would have fell into that forest farmer category. Mm-hmm. But can you just describe how United Plant Savers and this sort of information about forest farming, medicinal plants, what the goals of that are, and maybe sort of the overall mission of why that makes sense to do that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so basically it's a conservation through cultivation type of strategy in part. So the forest farming work is really about trying to teach people how to produce these plants, and we want them to be produced at scale, you know, at large volume, so they can then sell that material into the botanical industry, you know, directly to botanical companies who are going to make a product. So that's the end goal, you know, take the pressure off the wild populations as much as possible, help people create an income opportunity by cultivating these plants. And I guess, you know, we've kind of alluded to it, but haven't specifically said it. You know, these plants that we are primarily working with are, you know, forest species. They need forest cover to survive. So when people produce these plants in the forest understory, it's a forest retention strategy and a sustainable forest management strategy as well. So keeping that forest intact, you know, provides multiple other benefits, you know, to the environment. And, you know, we are all familiar with those, you know, I mean, carbon sequestration, you know, migratory bird habitat, wildlife, you know, fungi, mycorrhiza, insects, you know, all that good stuff. You know, so it all, you know, kind of comes together in this really nice package where you get just a lot of co-benefits. And around here, you know, in this region, you know, United Plant Savers works nationally. You know, it's a national organization. But we are located here. We have a 60-70 acre preserve down here in Rutland, Ohio. It's called the Golden Seal Sanctuary. Hiking trails and really nice diverse populations of wildflowers and you know, older Appalachian, you know, hardwood forest. So it's a destination, you know, and a place where we can do demonstration as well. So a lot of our forest farming education, you know, in this area looks like, you know, workshops and events and demos and getting people out on the property so they can kind of see the plants, you know, see how we plant them, see how we manage them. You know, we also are distributing seed and rootstock for a variety of species, you know, as a way to help people get that material and get it planted and get it in the ground and get them started. So we've got a workshop coming up here in a couple weeks. We've got a ramp cultivation workshop, and so we'll be teaching folks about ramps, and we'll be doing a planting demo, and then we'll do a little taste test. We'll make some ramp pesto and a couple value-added products, just kind of show people what it's like to, you know, how you can sustainably, you know, make a business opportunity or supplemental income. You know, we're not talking, you know, getting rich or anything like that, but just supplemental income, you know, it's an incentive for people to keep that forest. You know, around here, very low income, and, you know, throughout Appalachia, where most of our at-risk forests are, you know, a lot of income, low income, a lot of challenges. There's a lot of pressure, you know, people are, you know, they'll stop by your house, knock on your door and say, I'll give you, you know, $30,000 for your timber and, you know, and cash sale. And, you know, there goes your forest. And, you know, that quite often does not work out well for the landowner or the health of the forest. So forest farming is a way to incentivize, just keeping that forest there intact, provides a way to maybe earn a little supplemental income, and of course the conservation benefit to the plants. So
yeah, and it gets people to care about their forests.
It absolutely does. I mean, so before I worked at United Plant Savers, for 15 years, I worked for another nonprofit here locally called Rural Action, and I was the non-timber forest product specialist over there for many years and director of the Sustainable Forestry Program. So I've been doing the forest farming work a long time, in partnership with United Plant Savers, all these years. And I can personally say that I've definitely seen it get people interested in their forest and get them interested in kind of what's happening out there. And, it definitely can get them interested in, and it gets them interested in other things, too. I mean, it could be birds or, butterflies or ants or, whatever it is, So, definitely a lot of positive benefits. And, so UPS is, we're doing a lot of education. We're part of a couple different regional partnerships through some grant projects. We're part of the Appalachian Beginning Forest Farmers Coalition. That's basically 10 or so regional partners from North Carolina on up, now expanding into the Northeast with a group of Northeast Forest Farmers Coalition. Part of the West Virginia Forest Farming Initiative with some partners at U Mountain Center over in Pocahontas County, West Virginia, Hillsboro, West Virginia. So we're trying to, be part of the bigger picture, and, we're just lucky to be able to work with good partners. And in the last couple of years, we've had opportunity to start planting a lot more rootstock on the property, and that's part of the position that I was brought on to do, is to produce more rootstock that can then go to growers to plant. So we've planted about close to 200 pounds of golden seal in the last 2-3 years, and a variety of other species as well, Solomon seal, black cohosh, trillium, all kinds of stuff, bloodroot. So we'll be looking forward to that coming online in the next year or two as we're able to start pulling roots out of the ground and propagating them out.
So you guys are starting all that stuff from seed?
So we've got rootstock from some cultivated growers in Canada, and we're able to subdivide those and plant those out and into beds. And we're going to be now, this is kind of part of the new kind of growing this propagation work. We will be doing a lot of seed propagation for golden seal specifically, as well as some other vegetative propagation off of off the rootlets that we're experimenting with as well. So, yeah, we're going to be we have a lot of golden seal on the property. Obviously it's named the Golden Seal Sanctuary. Mm-hmm. So we have a lot of seed stock that we can collect and work with, and generate new seedlings that way. So we're going to be exploring all of that this coming season. I just personally started with United Plant Savers last summer, so this will be our first full season doing some more of this propagation work on site. So
yeah, it sounds fun.
Look forward to it.
So for your, for somebody who's maybe interested in forest farming, and they want to, maybe they have a piece of property that they're not planning to log or anything like that, is there any species that's sort of easier to start with than another one to maybe try for forest farming?
I mean, in my opinion, it's good to start with a little bit of a diversity of species. But really a lot of it depends on your site, what's your, so it can vary based on the growing site and the conditions and the soils and, topography and all that kind of stuff really can factor in. So It's not necessarily just a blanket, you know, you can grow ginseng anywhere, golden seal anywhere. You know, they do have their kind of little specifics that they tend to favor. But generally speaking, you know, most people start with ginseng because it's fairly simple and it's a long-term crop. You're generally looking at 7 to 10 years before you're probably pulling anything out of the ground, you know, worthwhile, unless you're selling, you know, baby rootlets or something like that. So it takes a long time, you know, so it's good to start getting it in the ground and, you know, keep that going every year, and then you kind of build up a nice supply. And then, you know, you can dabble in some other stuff, you know, and see what works best, you know, and that's kind of the key. You know, golden seal tends to be a nice one because it's pretty resistant to deer. Deer don't browse it because it's a bitter herb, you know, so it's not great foliage for them to browse on. So it's pretty uncommon to see that. So that's a good, you know, a good plus for golden seal and ramps as well. Definitely a big proponent of ramp cultivation. It's a really easy species to grow if you have a good growing site. Again, the deer don't really browse the plants at all. You know, they don't like the, you know, ramps are an allium, so they have a strong flavor of garlic and onions. So they don't like that, so they don't browse them as well, and they're very naturally disease-resistant, you know, super easy to grow using wild simulated methods, which is, you know, basically, we haven't really talked about the methodologies, but,
yeah,
you know, wild, you know, so those are the three, you know, big ones that people tend to start with. You know, anything that produces a rhizome, you know, and can be subdivided is good, you know, because it's easy to make new plants if the plant is happy. You know, you can take cuttings off of the root. So Solomon seal, golden seal, black cohosh, bloodroot, they all do pretty well. And you know, if you don't have forest, people can cultivate these in a more landscape setting. You know, you just got to basically provide the proper amount of shade. So that can work for folks as well, depending on what type of garden and landscape situation you have. So species like bloodroot and, you know, wild geranium and, you know, even Solomon seal and black cohosh, you know, can do really well out with a lot of sun. You know, I mean, they might only need 25-30% shade, you know, so they can get sun for most of the day, and they tend to get larger, they're more showy, produce more flowers, all that good stuff. And they also produce more seeds, so, you know, that's also something you can experiment with if you're looking to produce your own seed stock. You know, there are definite ways to kind of work with the plants, and you kind of start to feel, you know, what their different habitat requirements are and, you know, how they perform in different sites, and all that factors into what you can grow, you know?
Yeah. After I had listened to you all about the ginseng, the wild simulated ginseng, I bought probably 1500 seeds from, this company in Michigan. And I think they were, you know, wild simulated seeds themselves. And I, you know, you guys had described sort of picking a more north facing slope.
Yep.
And pulling the leaf litter down to expose the soil and sort of like little rows, you know, with the contour, and then scatter your seed in those where the bare ground is, and then pull the leaf litter down back on top of it.
Yep, exactly. That's the wild simulated method.
And I'll have to check this spring. It's, you know, those seeds were 18 months stratified, so I had, it was sort of the level up of getting really fresh seed. You know, they had that 18 month life in the refrigerator.
Yep.
And I put them out and I didn't see one come up. And I, you know, it might be I live in sort of a more, I've got like red maple. It's kind of a mixed forest, but it's also attached to a field.
Mm-hmm.
There was, you know, it's surrounded by rock walls, so there's probably a history of either cows or sheep being grazed here.
Sure.
And, you know, the soil is kind of wet, and, you know, it might be a little more acidic than I probably have granite as my geology, my ground geology. So it's not a particularly rich site, which is what I would think of, you know, where ginseng would probably like better.
Yeah, I mean, that's, yeah, generally the, you know, like I said, older forests, you know, the north and east side of the hill tends to be, you know, the more rich side of the hill, or, you know, the shadier aspect, cooler aspect, receives less direct sun throughout the day. So those tend to be our best sites when we're looking at forest production. You know, ginseng is pretty particular. It does prefer probably the best sites, you know. That's where ginseng thrives the best, where you have the most organic matter and just the soil is really dark and really good and loose. You know, so there are a lot of challenges and a small amount of seeds, you know. I mean, part of wild simulated is you kind of overseed, you know, thinking that you're going to have some that probably just don't make it, you know, because exposed to the elements, some might get eaten by critters or something. So you're kind of accounting for a little bit of a die-off over the life of the plants, or maybe a little lower germination. So 1,500 seeds can be a small amount, you know. I mean, you should have seen something if it was good site and the seed was good. Ginseng also doesn't, you know, has a seedling form, so the plants are very, very small, and they don't look like a ginseng plant really at all. So they can be easily overlooked as well. So, I mean, the plants are generally only about an inch tall, and the leaves are maybe an inch long. You know, for the
yeah, I'm crossing my fingers that this is the. I'm hoping that they just freaked out and didn't stick their heads up above the soil last spring, and maybe I'll see them this one.
Well, a little wetter maybe. Site could do good for ramps. Ramps can tolerate some moisture.
I have transplanted ramp bulbs here, and they've done really well, even in, you know, more sunnier locations.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
I have ramps are something that's really abundant around here, and we have, you know, sort of that, like what I imagine your ginseng rush is like, you know, here for ramps is something like that. And it's people bringing bulbs to restaurants and selling them. And, you know, there is always every spring, there's the message of like, don't harvest the bulbs, just take a leaf off of, you know, 10% of the plants.
That's important.
Yeah, and it's almost the same. It tastes exactly the same. You'd never know. And the only time that I ever actually physically move any of those plants is when they're getting sort of like spaced out a little bit in a place where they're wall to wall. We'll go in and take out some bulbs and then transplant them somewhere else.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's easy to do it sustainably when you have a nice, robust population to work with. Yep. We get that around here too, you know, and it's kind of hit or miss, you know. I mean, ramps are, you know, they're not everywhere. I mean, but yeah, where they are, there are a lot of them, and you know, we have that same thing. There's buyers that set up here, you know, they fly them out to Colorado, you know, on next day air, you know. So you
oh
do
God.
See it. I mean, yeah, it's coming, but certainly that's a big part of our message with ramps, you know, is trying to talk about the non-detrimental harvest techniques. So, you know, taking leaf only, or you can do a cut stock method, you know, depending, and that bulb should, you know, depending on the vigor of the plant and the population, and those bulbs should regrow the next year. So, yeah, we try and focus on that and bring attention to those methodologies in all our educational opportunities that we, or activities that we do.
Yeah, so we mentioned methodology. Should we discuss that now?
Sure, yeah. I mean, you basically just covered the wild simulated. You know, there's two primary methods for forest cultivation that people tend to use. And we have, so you have wild simulated and woods cultivated. And wild simulated, as the name implies, it's just basically trying to mimic the wild conditions that the plants would normally grow in. So you describe seeding ginseng by basically going out to a good site, raking back the leaf litter, broadcasting the seeds, and then covering them back up with the leaves. That just allows the plant to germinate on top of the soil like it would if it was dispersed from a parent plant. And, you know, it'll grow in place there for its entire life. And over the course of 10 or 12 years or so, that population should, you know, kind of thin out to resemble something similar to a wild population with about, you know, one to two plants per square foot, you know, something like that. So it's really just, it's very low input. You're not really manipulating the site at all other than some basic light pruning. In our forest understory, we have a lot of shrubby growth, spice bush in particular. So sometimes you got to prune some limbs back, you know, just kind of like open it up a little bit, and you have to periodically come back in and do that every couple years just to make sure that the plants don't get too shaded, you know, and too overtopped. But other than that, there's really no manipulation of the growing site. And that's why it's really, really important to choose a good site where the plants are going to thrive naturally, you know, because that's key to wild simulated. And the other method, woods cultivated, is more intensive. You're basically cultivating the soil. So some people will take a tractor or a heavy-duty tiller in there and, you know, actually till a bed after removing a lot of the competitive vegetation, small tree seedlings, shrubs, you know, anything like that from where the bed's going to be. So it's a more complete removal of the vegetation in the planting site, and you would be tilling the soil for faster root growth, and hopefully higher yields would be the intention. So quite a bit more preparation, more time investment in that site prep, and there's definitely more disturbance to the site. Mm-hmm. But there are benefits, you know, there are times when it would work to your advantage. So woods cultivated can be really good for any species that produces rhizomes and spreads vegetatively. So golden seal would be particularly good, Solomon seal, bloodroot. So, you know, as those fibrous roots and tubers kind of rhizomes spread through the soil, that looser growing medium, you know, they start to produce more plants, you know, little new sprouts from their feeder roots, or when they get the rhizomes, say like a bloodroot will kind of branch out, you know. So it's a different thing, you know, they have different forms of the way they spread, but essentially that looser soil will make them spread faster, and then you can either get higher yields, or if your goal is to make more propagules, then they're going to make more propagules for you in that looser soil. So that could be a good thing if that's what you're trying to do. Some things doesn't make sense for. So, you know, wild simulated production makes perfect sense for ginseng because the root is going to look wild. If you took a ginseng and cultivated it in a cultivated bed, the root's going to come out looking more like a carrot. It's going to be smoother. You know, you're going to be able to tell it grew real fast. And, you know, ginseng's value is largely based on what that root looks like, you know, because you want it to look as wild as possible because that's the most valuable form. So it doesn't make sense to necessarily cultivate ginseng in a woods cultivated production system if your goal is to sell the root for, you know, as a whole root. If you were going to sell it, say, chopped up just to be made into tincture, you know, then it might not matter so much, and you could do that. But generally speaking, woods cultivated beds require a little bit more management. You could get weeds in there from the disturbance of the soil. Diseases can also be more of an issue because a lot of the pathogens that affect a lot of these woodland medicinals are waterborne fungal pathogens. Looser soil allows, you know, water to kind of move through all the roots, you know, a little bit more and could spread, you know, fungi that way, or denser growth where the foliage is touching, you know, they can spread fungal spores that way. So you kind of got to experiment, know what you're getting into, what your end goals are, and, you know, what your management practices are going to be. You know, if you're not going to be interested in trying to control fungal disease that's going to rot away all your roots, then, you know, probably best to stick with wild simulated method and avoid the woods cultivated, you know, or something like that. Not to say that, you know, that's always going to happen in a woods cultivated system, but.
Yeah. The other thing, you know, I think we'd be remiss in not mentioning invasive plants and disturbance in the woods.
Sure, yeah.
I don't know if you guys have this, you know, New England has a huge problem with, you know, it's almost any time you go into a, you know, any piece of woods that sort of has a closed canopy or, you know, maybe 60 or 70, if you take some of that out, take some of those trees out and disturb the soil, it seems like almost 80 or 90% of the time you're getting invasive plants coming back.
Yeah, certainly. I mean, we struggle with invasives around here, you know, just like everywhere. You know, our forests have been highly disturbed. Anytime you have a forest reverting back, you know, from open pasture, there's always, you know, a lot of opportunity for stuff to establish early on there. You know, the woody invasives like autumn olive and multiflora rose and, you know, all those good ones. So that's typically what we have in the forest interior is mostly multiflora rose and autumn olive. And it's not everywhere. So typically when you're selecting a good site here, you know, to produce any of these plants, it's going to be by and large free of invasives. You know, it's just older forests, less disturbed. I mean, no invasives. That's ideal. You know, there might be a little bit of stuff in there, like multiflora rose here and there that you can like grub out. You know, they're everywhere, you know, birds drop seeds. You know, just because it's there doesn't mean it's a bad site by any means, you know, so just got to manage it kind of like you would manage any of the vegetation in your growing site. But yeah, if it's overrun with invasives, I mean, there are parts of Ohio, like in western Ohio, where literally the whole forest understory is nothing but invasives. Garlic mustard, stilt grass, bush honeysuckle, you know, all those things. So certainly if you have those on your property or you're working in any of those areas and then you're going to go try and do some forest farming, you know, pay attention to that. Make sure your tools are clean. You know, if you were using them to, you know, do something that might contribute to seed transfer, you know,
mm-hmm.
Put on your boots. You know, stilt grass is the big one around here that's really moved in a lot. And it's basically moved back. Anywhere a tire goes, like a tractor or an RTV or anything, if every trail that a tire reaches now has stilt grass on it, you know, basically around here. So that's one we're particularly concerned about because it has the ability to kind of thrive in the shade. You know, it can move into the forest understory, displace a lot of spring wildflowers and native plants. So,
yeah, it definitely takes over as a ground cover very quickly.
Yeah. And then the invasive pests, I mean, that's caused a big problem in the forest around here. You know, we lost all the ash to emerald ash borer. So certain stands, you know, ash was a pretty big component of the canopy, you know, so that allowed a lot of light in. You know, we've seen an impact on the golden seal populations that were underneath there, underneath that ash canopy. Definite decline over the last few years as the canopy has dropped away. I'm not exactly sure if that's just more sunlight or, you know, more moisture is getting down there and they don't like the moisture or what the deal is, but, you know, things like that. And there are a lot of other species in the forest that are being affected too. You know, sassafras is potentially vulnerable now.
To what?
There's a beetle called the ambrosia beetle that they're on the lookout for. It's basically causes what they call laurel wilt, so it affects spice bush, red bay, sassafras, you know, stuff in the Lauraceae family. So, and there's other diseases affecting them as well, you know. I mean, there's canker diseases and, you know, different kind of heart rots. And but we've seen a lot of sassafras dying recently, not necessarily to the beetle per se. Has not been officially declared here yet, but, you know, there's gypsy moth and oak wilts and black walnut. There's some spotted lantern fly that can, you know, kill. It was found up in the northeast Ohio. It can, like, kill just about any species of tree, supposedly. You know, so there's a lot of, you know, and these are all, you know, non-native, you know, pests that have been introduced. So there's a lot, you know, affecting the forest. And then, you know, you have climate change drivers, you know, more droughts, all that kind of stuff, you know, species compositional shifts, logging pressure, you know, all that is, all that's working to kind of make things harder for the forests and the plants that live in them and the animals that live in them and the people that, you know, care about them, I guess.
I heard a talk on white ash in New England recently because, well, they were talking about all ashes. We have three of them, so green, black, and white. And they were talking about the value of those and in sort of the hierarchy of the value of leaf litter. Basswood falls at the top in terms of how much value that leaf litter as it decomposes adds to the soil in nutrients. And then the one directly under that is white ash.
Oh, wow.
So, and black ash. And so the ash group there is right under basswood.
Interesting.
And so that might be, you know, thinking about, I had no idea that, and maybe you can clarify this, but, you know, in my mind, from what you said about white ash in Ohio, I'm thinking that there's, you know, if you see a healthy ash tree, that's a big deal.
Yeah, well, you just don't see them. I mean, you see small, young ones, and even they're starting to show signs. And there's been other diseases affecting ash here, too. But, yeah, that's interesting. I mean, that's an interesting point about basswood. Basswood's actually one of our favorite canopy trees, you know, when looking at forest farming sites. So if we're out, you know, assisting somebody on their property and kind of evaluating the site, or when I've done population monitoring on the national forest looking for populations, if I see big basswood, I'm definitely going to go check it out. And I've found a lot of really nice wild populations of select species, and found a lot of good cultivation sites, you know, with that tree. So that's one of the ones, along with tulip poplar and sugar maple. You know, if we see the three of those together in a site as the dominant one, or like co-dominant species, we know that's good. So all those species concentrate calcium into their leaf litter when they drop them in the fall, and that adds a lot of calcium to the soil. And almost all of these forest herbs are calcium-loving species. You know, they basically need it to thrive. You know, the more calcium in the soil tends to be associated with good, healthy, vigorous populations. I don't know that anybody's tested that with, you know, hard science, but definitely a couple observational and anecdotal lines of evidence there to lead me to believe that, you know, that those are some of the best trees, you know, for the understory, and that ties right into it, soil quality, you know, I mean.
Yeah.
So that's interesting.
Are you seeing a lot of, like, you know, white ash regen?
I mean, there's tons of seedlings, which is not uncommon. So even before the borer got here, it was pretty common to see in certain sites just a huge crop of ash seedlings on the forest floor, you know, all about, you know, 12, 14, 16 inches tall. Just real thick in there. And that was common before the borer, and that's still common now. So you see a lot of seedlings, like, in that stage. But, you know, as far as older trees, once they get up to a couple inches diameter, they start to, like, get affected by diseases and pests, it seems like.
Yeah, I don't know what the current status in Vermont is with emerald ash borer. I know it's still on our sort of radar to keep an eye out for.
Mm-hmm.
I live right on the edge of Green Mountain National Forest, and they have EAB traps up along the road.
Yeah.
You know, a lot, when I go out into the forest, though, I see lots of big mature ash trees that are they're seemingly doing fine, as well as regen everywhere. So I don't know if there's sort of a, you know, a fire break that's happening somewhere.
It's probably like the coldness of the length of the winter, really. I mean,
yeah.
I mean, it must have something to do with that. I mean,
and they're really for a long time, at least a decade, maybe longer than that, maybe way longer than that. We've had, like, you know, if we go camping in Maine, I can't take firewood with me from Vermont. You know,
yeah,
really illegal. And so they've
had
that,
all that.
Yeah, that type of thing all built in for a while. So,
yeah.
It would be so detrimental to have that tree species. I can't imagine what it looks like.
Do you know what percentage of the composition ash represents?
Oh, I would say like 30. I can't be quoted on that, but that's probably.
I think close. That's about where we were at down here, was somewhere like in the 20 to 30 range.
Mm-hmm.
It was a pretty small, you know, obviously there's stands where, you know, the ash was more represented, you know.
Yeah.
And then, you know, other areas where it's just like scattered. But yeah, that's about where we were at. But other parts of Ohio, up in like Northeast Ohio, it was like 70%. It was really high in some areas. So they really lost, like, the forests up there, which the forests up there are more, you know, tracts of forests, like, generally surrounded by fields or development, you know. It's very patchy up there, but, yeah, there was definite stands up there where they were decimated by the loss of ash. But, yeah, even at 20-30%, you know, it can make an impact. And
oh, yeah. Getting back to, like, this, the wild simulated and woods cultivated stuff, are there resources for sellers? I'm just imagining, you know, somebody going out and planting, like I did, planting a bunch of ginseng seeds. If I had had all those germinate and was 10 years down the road, who am I getting to buy that stuff?
So it could go a couple different ways. The traditional way, you know, 10 years ago, and probably still common for a lot of people right now who have cultivated ginseng, is they're basically going to try and just take it down to whoever's buying wild ginseng and sell it as wild and try and get wild price for it. So there's that route, which, you know, is not, it's a legal gray area, because, you know, when you sell the ginseng, the buyer generally has to mark, is it that it's wild or it's cultivated. And then some states might have a box for wild simulated. But either way, you know, a lot of the grower is going to go in and say it's wild, because if they say it's anything other than wild, then the buyer is going to try and give them a lower price.
Right.
So you have people doing that. Then you have people who are selling it direct themselves. So you'll have people who will sell it on Etsy or eBay, you know, stuff like that. Then you have people who are probably a little bit more larger scale, a little bit more connected, like business savvy. They're going to be selling, you could sell, say, direct to a small herbal products company. Say, like, you know, Bamboo Botanicals or whatever. You know, that's just a made-up name. You know, they're making a ginseng extract. And they want to make it with, you know, wild simulated ginseng. Like, they want to advertise that this is not wild, you know, because there is, you know, stigma on, you know, wild in herbal products, you know, in the herbal community, you know, because of the conservation issue. So, you know, maybe you can go sell that route. Or, you know, there's bigger companies like Mountain Rose Herbs has invested in buying ginseng root that is wild simulated and has gone through what we call the forest grown verification program that United Plant Savers now owns and manages. So basically the forest grown program is very similar to say like organic certification. But you know, it's basically just verifying that you're a grower of this plant, you know, you produced it and, you know, this is how you produced it. You know, these are the methods that you used. So it's a third-party verification system, basically for producers of select non-timber forest products. And this is a new program, fairly new. United Plant Savers just purchased it in 2020. Obviously, it's been a weird couple years, so, you know, still in the growth stages and getting it out there, but it was started by another company, or it's a collaborative effort of many stakeholders, but it was started in Pennsylvania in 2017 or so, I believe, or 16, exclusively for wild simulated ginseng. Is basically a way to document that, hey, this is not wild ginseng, because with ginseng you have this very, you know, strange relationship, because, you know, wild ginseng is so heavily regulated. You're growing a product that you want to look wild and basically sell as wild or get a wild price for, but yet you don't want it to be regulated as wild, you know, in case anything happens to the regulations for actual wild ginseng. You know, if they shut down the harvest and sale and export of wild ginseng because of, you know, endangered species issues, you know, you could be, you know, quite quickly lose potential access to your, you know, top market, you know, as a wild simulated grower without there being some kind of other documentation or way to kind of segregate you from the wild regulations. So that was kind of the impetus behind the forest grown program, and it expanded, you know, to producers of other species, you know, aside from ginseng. So there's 9 plant species or 10 plant species on the list right now that people can be verified for. So
does that cost money? Do you have to get a?
It does cost money, but right now it is currently being funded through a grant, I believe, or either a donation, one of the two. So it is subsidized right now, but yeah, typically there's an application fee and then an inspection fee. So you need a baseline inspection, and then harvest years also you get an inspection after the harvest to make sure that basically what you reported on your paperwork matches up with what is on the ground. So it's a very small program. There's only about 16 people in it currently.
Are they all over the place, all over the country?
About 9 or 10 different states, mostly, eastern Appalachian states.
And so do you have people, like, who's doing the certifications after each harvest? Is that people locally?
Well, so there was a variety. So under the original program owner, the original program owner was also an organic certifier. So everything was done by organic inspectors. Since the transfer of the program, it's been done by UPS staff or partners in the forest farming work, you know, regionally that work for other organizations. You know, who are generally a part of like the Appalachian Beginning Forest Farmer Coalition, people that we can reach out to in that area to go out and, you know, just do the walkthrough. So that's how it's been done thus far. So that's the hardest part is, you know, most people are very small and they're really in the program because they believe in the value of this, you know, documenting sustainability. And part of the program is also trying to enable growers to sell direct. So we just mentioned those different options on selling the ginseng, you know. Well, the bottom rung is taking it to the wild buyer. You know, that's your bottom. You're going to get the lowest price there, especially for any product other than ginseng. So if you cultivated Solomon seal, took it to a wild buyer, you know, they're going to pay you the wild price, which is probably like, you know, I don't know, $5 or $6 a pound or something. I mean, very, very cheap, you know, $3 a pound. So, you know, that's obviously not a profitable price for somebody who just spent, you know, 4, 5, 6 years organically cultivating, you know, this nice root. So what we want people to do is sell at the top of the chain, you know, selling direct. So either direct to that, you know, small apothecary or direct to, you know, a company like Mountain Rose or somebody like that who, you know, Mountain Rose created a whole forest-grown product line, so you can actually check that out on their website. They have a forest-grown ginseng line. I think they have a tincture, and then they have a like a whole root. You can buy like one individual like whole root, comes in like a nice tin. And they're also doing leaf, forest-grown verified leaf as well. So, you know, that's kind of where we're trying to go. You know, obviously the supply and the demand, you know, they have to, you know, all be on the same page. So, you know, it's going to take time. It's a growth yeah. process. But, you know.
I think that makes sense. That sounds like a cool little program for somebody to get involved in.
Yeah, they can. You know, people can check it out on the United Plant Savers website. You just go to unitedplantsavers.org and look under programs, and you'll see Forest Grown Verified. And there's a bunch of documents there kind of about the program, and people can check it out there.
Nice.
The United Plant Savers Instagram and Facebook accounts, so people can jump on there, check us out. If anybody has any questions about anything we talked about here today, they can reach me by email at tanner@unitedplantsavers.org, or they can try and catch up with us on the office phone, which is 740-742-3455.
Cool.
Yeah.
Well, thanks so much, Tanner. This has been really fun. Happy spring.
Likewise.
Yeah.
Thanks a bunch.
Take it easy. We'll see you.
All right, take care.
Bye.